It is 19 UTC on Saturday, the 7th of May, in the glorious future year of 2022, and I am Publius, bringing you A Step Farther Out, your weekly radio message from the Man at Adams Society. And I'm trying something new, technically speaking, this week, partly because last week I messed something up and we didn't have a show go out. And partly just because I found it interesting, and you know me, sometimes I just do things because they're interesting. So what is interesting this week? Let's see, I mentioned last time that I'd had a new film come back, Energy, the Nuclear Alternative. Well, I've had, since then, yet another film come back. Or rather, it's not back yet. It'll probably be here Monday, because the transfer house sent it out on Wednesday, and they always send things UPS or FedEx, which don't deliver ordinarily on Saturdays, unless you pay extra, whereas the post office does deliver on Saturdays. Just one more reason to love the post office. Now that film, the one that I am having come back, and will probably be available for your viewing pleasure on Monday evening sometime, or Tuesday morning, depending on your time zone. And I'll probably talk about it on my Tuesday show. There's actually two reels of film. One reel is a film which I bought, I guess, largely because it starts off with a can-do. Starts off with showing the fueling sequence, actually, the fueling machine in a can-do power reactor, which is pretty darn nifty. Most of the film, however, is about tidal and solar energy, particularly a tidal power plant in France and the big solar furnace that they constructed down in the south of France. And as a matter of fact, in the mail, when I picked it up at my post office box yesterday, was another film that I bought because the seller claims it has something about a nuclear plant in it. Maybe not the best reason to buy anything, I will admit. But it is an Italian production, Panorama Italiana, some kind of Italian newsreel-type feature produced by RAI, the Italian broadcaster. And it looks as though it has something to do with one of the early nuclear power plants in Italy. And whether that's Latina, the British-built Magnox station, or Garigliano, the American-built station, is an interesting question. I don't know yet. But the other film that should be coming back with the solar and tidal film is a French newsreel, which the seller said that about half of it was devoted to Fessenheim, the first of the French PWR stations, when it first opened. It's a fairly late newsreel, 1977 or 78. Anyway, so we shall see what is there. And of course I have two very good French films. One is explicitly a classroom film for schools that's got a study guide, and the other is a quite early film about nuclear electricity, which I think may cover Marcoule. Anyway, those need to go out for transfer, as do the four Russian language films that I bought from a fellow in the west part of Ukraine just about the time the war started over there. But they did all reach me. And so there's one that's nuclear energy specifically, and the other three are about electric power and have significant sections on nuclear energy in them. And of course, those are in the Russian language. So, you know, and then I have a bunch of other films. So having films transferred is not cheap. It's actually cheaper to buy the films in most cases than to have them transferred. So if you do feel the desire to send me some money on account of that, believe you me, I will not be offended. I will welcome it. Let's see. Other unwise purchases I have made lately. A giant novelty light bulb, except it's a real light bulb. It is a Mogul base, that's E39 base, 750-watt incandescent lamp for use on 120 volts. And it looks just like an ordinary incandescent lamp. Frosted envelope, the type A shape, except for being 15 centimeters in its largest diameter and 35 centimeters long. So it just looks like a giant novelty light bulb. But it is, in fact, a real light bulb. I haven't yet bought a base for it, a socket. I got it cheap at the Habitat for Humanity thrift store, and they didn't seem to have a socket. I wouldn't dare use it during air conditioning season, but I keep thinking, well, I could build an easy bake oven with this, which would just be a regular oven. But of course, the major unwise purchase I have made recently is the thing. I am going to have to do a video stream shortly so that you can see the thing and get a real good idea of it. Also to show you my giant novelty light bulb and drink a can of that space-flavored Coca-Cola that I did end up buying. What is the thing? Well, it's hard to describe. It's sort of a super-class paperweight. It's got a wooden base and a bronze plaque, and in the middle of the plaque is cut a slot, which has two magnets in it, which repel each other. And it says, July 12th, 1955, West Milton, New York. Progress is our most important product, General Electric. And then it says, energy stored in these Alnico magnets came from the AEC's Submarine Intermediate Reactor Prototype on the occasion of America's first commercial distribution of atomic electric power for farm, home, and industry. And as I have mentioned in the past, the West Milton, Submarine Intermediate Reactor turbo generator was turned onto the grid literally a day before Borax 5 was used to power the town of Arco, Idaho, all the way across the country. There was a great deal of competition for this kind of precedence. Of course, that was about the same time that the Soviets brought the Obninsk nuclear power plant online, a little 5-megawatt job, which they like to call the first civil nuclear power plant in the world, but it was really more of an experimental prototype or something than a practical power system. And then only a couple of months later, you had in Britain Calder Hall coming on the line, and each of those reactors was 45 megawatts, and in fact later uprated. They, on the other hand, were intended first and foremost to produce plutonium for military purposes with electricity as a byproduct, although for most of their lives they did run as electricity producers rather than plutonium producers. So yes, and there are still things that I would like to buy. So again, anyone who wants to send me money, you can be sure that I'll spend it unwisely, but in an entertaining manner. Let's see, what else is interesting to talk about today? Well, of course, you've got a lot of political excitement in the United States, which tends to bring out the worst in people's argumentation skills. I mean, I keep seeing people making arguments to the effect of such and such social problem disproportionately affects pregnant women and women with small children, so let's just make abortion really easy to get, and then we won't have to worry about fixing that social problem. And I'm thinking, that is an amazingly bad argument for your position. If you set out to make a bad argument, you could not have done better. Bravo. Let's see. Oh, I should mention recent Here Now the Word shows I've been reading the science and editorial columns out of old Analog and Astounding magazines. You might find some interest in that. But the draft opinion by Samuel Alito that was leaked worries me in a completely unrelated way, because he's constructing this standard he calls deeply rooted in history, which, if we take it seriously, would seem to imply that he doesn't believe Congress has the power to legislate on anything that wasn't part of daily life in 1787. So we could say, for example, airplanes or television. If those are left to the states to regulate, things become very complicated. Or does he perhaps mean that Congress has the power to legislate on things beyond where the grants, that the grants of power to legislate in the Constitution extend beyond the guarantees of rights in the Constitution? That is possibly even worse. So, I don't know what he's trying to do there, and I don't know what it's in service of, but I think people need to ask themselves that question very strongly, because it's obvious to me that, to be frank, abortion is being used as a stalking horse here to obtain some change in the law for some purpose. And I can't make out what it is, but I don't think it's going to be good. Now, what else is there to be said? Oh, speaking of air aviation and air travel and the states, I read that in the Wall Street Journal that air travel in Florida is being disrupted because there are too many space launches. To which I say, yay! Maybe we can finally get some more train service to Florida, considering that Amtrak's service on the Sunset Limited has been stopped at New Orleans for some 15 years now, which is absolutely ridiculous. I wrecked a car going to the last space shuttle launch because there was no Amtrak service. Amtrak didn't lay on special trains to take people to the last space shuttle launch. No, why would they do that? There were only 1 million people going there, and they all came by car. It's not a surprise I got into a car wreck. It's a surprise more people didn't. It's a surprise anybody at all made it out of there with an intact car, because there were a lot of wrecks that weekend in the vicinity of Cocoa Beach. Also, apparently Boeing, not being content with having moved its offices away from Seattle to Chicago, because building airplanes is much less important than hobnobbing with a global business elite, has decided to move its headquarters from Chicago to the Northern Virginia area, the area around Washington, D.C., after having finally realized that, the people they really want to talk to, the people they really want to cozy up with, are in the U.S. government. The people who sign defense contracts, the people who regulate them. You know, forget being in the airliner business, being in the airplane business at all. They're in the selling things to the government business, and that's all they care about. So, getting back to one of my hobby horses that you've heard a lot about recently, whale oil, or in this case, palm oil. Yes, friends, Indonesia has decided, in the face of food shortages in the offing, Indonesia has decided to embargo the export of palm oil, which is a foodstuff as well as being used in Germany as motor fuel. So yeah, Germans are not going to be able to get that tasty, tasty biodiesel that, you know, the rainforests have been slashed and burned to provide them, you know. It's the most environmentally friendly thing in the world, don't you know? I remember reading somebody from the 19th century commenting that the synthesis of indigo and alizarin was a great benefit to the human race, because now those substances could be provided from coal rather than from plants, with the result that vast areas cultivated in indigo and madder plants could be turned over to cultivating food, thus pushing back starvation, which was, of course, a constant problem in the world of 1850. It's pathetic that we should have to worry about this now, with all the advances we've had in agriculture, but we do, because people have chosen that. I don't think it's a good choice. Pretty obviously, I don't. But clearly, Indonesia has taken a very different policy from the U.S., and Japan is admitting that they are going to have to go back to nuclear energy in order to avoid being reliant on imported fossil fuels, which was the whole reason they started on nuclear energy in the first place, to be fair. Now, when we talk about nuclear energy, you know, a lot of people have this idea that a nuclear accident would be a vast global catastrophe, and that, therefore, nuclear plants need to have the absolute highest standards, technically and in human terms, just unattainably high, and therefore we shouldn't even bother. That it would require superhuman operators, superhuman design engineers, and a degree of technical refinement and perfection in constructing and maintaining the plants that's just impossible, so we shouldn't even bother. I don't believe it. Why do I not believe it? Well, I look, for example, at Chernobyl. What do we learn from Chernobyl? Well, after 35 years of following the liquidators, right, the people who went in to deal with the immediate aftermath of the accident, and realizing that the massive numbers of early cancer cases that we expected to occur haven't occurred, it becomes clear that the actual real-world consequences of even a very bad nuclear power plant accident, and as I've said before, Chernobyl was actually worse than the worst conceivable nuclear power plant accident. It is worse than the worst accident that could occur in any other kind of nuclear power station that's ever been licensed for civilian use. And it can't even happen at that type of plant anymore because they've been modified. But it's worse than the worst conceivable accident, and yet the consequences, even in somewhat favorable circumstances, the relatively low population density in northern Ukraine and the wind was blowing away from Kiev rather than toward it. Nevertheless, it becomes obvious that the actual real-world consequences of even a very bad nuclear accident are much less in terms of deaths of people than the consequences of a bad jetliner accident, right? The worst-case nuclear accident, if you were to set down Chernobyl in any spot in Europe where a nuclear power plant is actually located relatively close to a fairly high population density, even still, you're looking at a few hundred fatalities. You're looking at, and that's over the course of 20 years and more, not immediately, but you're looking at, you know, something resembling a bad jet accident. And that's the thing. Many, many countries which you would not regard as the most advanced in the world, Ethiopia as an example, many countries operate jetliners all the time, large numbers of them, right? And large accidents with jetliners are actually fairly uncommon. And it's not just operating them, right? Because yes, you know, Ethiopia and Sri Lanka and so on, they buy airliners from Boeing in the U.S., from Airbus in Europe. They also buy them from Embraer, Empresas Brasileiras Aeronáuticas, right? If you've ever flown on a regional jet, the likelihood is it was built in Brazil. And Brazil is, again, not in the front rank of the advanced, wealthy industrial countries. But they supply a great deal of the world's jetliner demand. So if we think of nuclear power as in the same category as jet airlines, then we realize that it is a realistic, right? It is a realistic solution for the energy needs of the world, in the same way that jetliners are a realistic solution for the transportation needs of the world. I say they are because that's what they're actually doing. So many of the people, even in poor countries, who go from one place to another today are traveling by jet airliner. Let's see. The bad ideas field, the Wall Street Journal the other day was cooing over something called algorithmic stablecoins, which in a very vague way resemble a proposal I had for stabilizing the dollar using gold, but only in a very vague way. And practically the next day there was an article about how some enterprising folks had managed to drain all of the value out of one of these things. So, don't buy NFTs, don't buy, cryptocurrency. If you're going to buy anything, buy a little extra of what you ordinarily buy at the supermarket, right? Buy a little extra food of the kind you normally keep around. You don't have to be a Mormon, right? The Mormons try to keep 6 months' worth of food in the house at all times. Staple stuff like flour, peanut butter, pickles. But you might buy a little more of what you usually buy so that you have a little in reserve in case those things become hard to get later in the year, because there are signs that will happen, as I already mentioned. Governments are already beginning to plan for food shortages. Now, a perennial question here is about machine civilization and how we keep it human. How we make sure that the priorities of the machine civilization are human priorities. Because we're the ones who build the machines. There's no reason why the machines should have an agenda that's different from ours, right? There's no reason why the machine should value anything that humans don't value. But that's been it's been very much something that people think about. Honestly, I think the bigger concern is that we have psychopaths and sociopaths, and we need to stop them from setting priorities. But I want to put something in your mind, right? I really think that human involvement is the most important thing. And by human involvement, I don't mean that you necessarily have to go to a job, that we have to stop automation so that people can go to jobs at factories, right? I don't think that's what it's all about at all. But people need to understand how things work. People need to be conscious of how things work. And I believe that starts with primary education. I mean, what are they teaching kids in school in the United States these days? Well, they're teaching them how to take tests, which is not exactly a valuable life skill. That's not something you're going to, need. That's not something that's going to be of any advantage to you at any time in your life. Take it from me. I'm really good at it. It doesn't do me a damn bit of good. And they're teaching kids how to avoid getting shot if somebody comes into a school with a gun, because people's right to carry guns everywhere is more important than anything else that we could possibly do or want as a society. So my opinion is, we should scrap the whole curriculum. Because frankly, a lot of it is designed around sort of Taylorization, Taylorism, and we don't need to be Taylorized, all right? We have automation for that now. The whole system of treating people as cogs in a machine is irrelevant when you have actual machines, as I've said repeatedly. So what do we need? Well, the first thing is every school class should have a garden. They should be planting seeds, they should be watching plants grow, and eating the produce. Now, I don't know, of course people are going to say, well, what about, okay, well, you could have chickens and have them produce eggs, and you can eat eggs. You could see how that works, too. Now, somebody's going to say, well, are you then going to go to the thing of having, your second grade class wring a chicken's neck and cut it up and eat it? I think a lot of people would be very much freaked out by that. I am not a vegan, and I don't believe in ethical veganism, ethical vegetarianism, but I do think that if you're going to eat meat, you ought to admit the fact. And so, I mean, frankly, you probably wouldn't have much difficulty getting a second grade class to kill and eat a chicken. But that's not necessarily to the point. But I do believe that Our primary schools should be taking field trips every week. They should be going to the waterworks. They should be going to the power plant. They should be going to a grain elevator. They should be going to a flour mill. They should, if all possible, be going to a farms, right? They should be going every place to see how all the various parts of our organized civilization work together. That the grain is sown by the farmer, he's got his tractor, he's got his harrow, he's got his combine harvester, he harvests the grain, puts it in a truck, takes it to the grain elevator, and the grain elevator puts it onto a train, the train takes it to a flour mill, the flour mill makes it into flour, which is then sent to the bakery makes it into bread, and the bread takes it to your store, and from the store you bring it home. Kids need to understand how the world works, because adults don't understand it. Most adults out there seem to think that water comes out of the tap, and electricity comes out of the wall, and food comes from the supermarket. So if we're going to have a machine civilization, which we must have to support 7.5 billion people on this planet, people have to understand how it works, how all the complicated interconnected parts work. And that brings me to the nominal subject of all of this ranting, which is, who pays for your power? This came out of a discussion in an on-radio comm room on SDF the other day after A Step Farther Out, when somebody was saying, people were comparing motor fuel prices, gasoline prices, and somebody was saying, well, I don't have to worry about that, I have an electric car. And so I said, well, what are you paying for electricity? He says, well, I don't pay for electricity, I've got solar. And I said, well, how does that work? You know, what do? You're plugging in your car at night, and your solar panels only work during the day. He says, well, I'm connected to the grid. So I think we need to ask the question, who's paying for your power? Now, we've already established that distribution and transmission, the grid itself, is something like 40% of the cost of conventional central station power. And that goes up considerably. The absolute cost of that goes up considerably when you're dealing with distributed generation, which is non-dispatchable. In other words, things like rooftop solar. So even if you count out the cost of generation entirely, you still have to pay for the grid. So who's paying for that? But here's another aspect, right? You know, so whoever it is that's generating the power that you're using at night, well, they're not getting paid by you during the night because you're not paying a power bill. And they're not getting paid during the day because that's when your solar panels are producing and they can't sell electricity if your solar panels are producing. So who's paying for that generation? Now, you may say, well, batteries will solve everything. Firstly, that's extremely implausible from a physical perspective. But even if they did, again, you have to ask the question. The batteries, as we've mentioned before about Norway and Denmark, right? Whoever owns the battery is going to have to buy power at a lower price than he sells it. Otherwise, he can't pay off the cost of the batteries he installed, right? Not to mention, you know, that batteries aren't 100% efficient, etc. But that's the thing. Who's paying for your power? To a great extent, it seems as though the answer is people who can't install PV, right? People living in apartments in cities rather than in fairly large houses in suburban or rural areas. Which sort of implies, in many cases, not always, certainly, but in many cases, that people with a lower income than you, people who can't afford to own their own house, people who can't afford to install solar panels, are the ones who are paying for your power. Now, in what world is that just or reasonable? I think that we have to ask this question. Who is paying for your power? If you're not paying for it, somebody else is paying for it. And you say, well, industry will pay for it. Well, in that case, it raises their costs, which means that they've got to raise their prices, which rises in prices affect the lowest income people first. Or they're going to close down because their prices have risen. That's already happened in Germany. Right, some of the largest industries in Germany are shutting down because primary energy is either too costly or too unreliable. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on a Non-Radio. I welcomed your letters, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
7, 6, 5.